There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with your coolest conversations throwback in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My interview with Charlie Starr of Blackberry Smoke originally aired January the 6th, 2017. The band is from Atlanta, Georgia, and formed in the year 2000. They're fronted by Charlie, and we spoke about the coolness of hee-haw, growing up north of Auburn, Alabama, his first guitar, his father's bluegrass playing, the band's forming in early days, as well as their performing on the Outlaw Country Cruise. Their most recent album at the time was Like an Arrow, which featured the coolest song in the world, Let It Burn. Let's hear some of that now, followed by my talk with Charlie Starr on your Coolest Conversations throwback, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Manfred here with you, and today I am joined by Charlie Starr from Blackberry Smoke. How are you, Charlie?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Very happy to have you with me today. And I have to ask you, maybe this show predates you, but maybe not. Are you a fan of hee-haw?
I am, yeah. When I was a little kid, it came on Saturday evening.
Well, I am as well, and I'm asking you, because we just took a listen to this week's coolest song of the world, your tune, Let It Burn, and the lyric in there, well, if it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have no luck at all. It made me think of the bit that they used to do on Hee Haw, where they had the line, if it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all, gloom, despair, and agony on me.
Yes. You know, I didn't even have Hee Haw in mind with that lyric. I had Lightnin' Hopkins in mind.
Oh, well, Lightnin' Hopkins is certainly cooler than Hee Haw, but Hee Haw is big in my heart because, you know, it's supposed to be like a country version of Laugh-In', and
right.
really corny. A lot of good dad joke material there. But, I mean, it's Roy Clark and Buck Owens, and the playing on there is just phenomenal. In fact, I just saw a clip that had a friend sent this to me. It was Glenn Campbell, Roy Clark, Buck Owens, all playing together a version of Riders on the Storm.
Yeah. I remember my fondest memories of Hee Haw, to be honest with you, were the girls. And I was really, really young, so I maybe wasn't quite sure what I was so excited about yet. But, you know, the ones with the little shorts on, with the piece of straw hanging out of their mouth. And, you know, it was quite suggestive for that type of TV program when I was a kid. But I loved it.
I had similar stirrings. Barbie Benton, she was on there. Since I brought up Let It Burn, well, to talk about it, it's on the new album, the latest album, Like an Arrow, that came out this past October. Does that song come from a specific instance or a moment in your life?
Probably a handful of moments. Well, there was, you know, the guy in the song, the main character, as it were, he cannot get out from under, and he feels like it's everybody's fault but his, and he blames it on the whole town, the town where he, I guess, is from or lives, and that was me, and I think that's been all of us at some point. But then the very last lyric of the song, or the last one of the last lines, you kind of realize, oh, well, it's his fault. So.
Well, Like an Arrow, that is your fifth album, and I guess you guys could refer to as Southern Rock, but on the album, you touch on all sorts of musical flavors, genres, from Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin flourishes to funky vibes and country twangs. Even have Greg Allman on the album. Tell me about the record and when and where you recorded it.
We recorded it last January in Atlanta, north of Atlanta, in Kennesaw, Georgia, a studio called The Quarry, which is now defunct. I just found out actually a couple of days ago it's closing its doors, and we made two albums there. Mm-hmm. But we went in January. We had a month off the road, and we didn't really know for sure if we were making an album or not. We were just going to go in and record a bunch of new songs. We had wrote a bunch of new songs, and we had started to rehearse them, and they felt so good, we just decided to go in and start recording. And I started to think, as we started to get to work, I thought, let's make an album. We're grown men. We've been doing this a long time together, you know. And I thought literally, and I said it to our drummer, I said, let's make a record. If we run into a problem, we'll call a producer. If we don't, then we'll have a record. And we never really ran into a problem. So that's really the way that it worked out.
And so if I understand you there, so it is a self-produced album. You produced it yourselves.
Yes.
And so since you've done that now, do you think that that's the road to go on in the future, or what does a producer offer anyway?
Well, I think that could be a slippery slope, because a producer, I think what they offer that's so valuable is an extra opinion and an outside opinion, somebody who's not so attached to the material, mm-hmm. or, you know, to the songs themselves, or to parts in songs, or to the way this songs are arranged, you know. And it's got to be somebody you trust, and we've worked with people that we trust very much, you know, Brendan O'Brien and Clay Cook, our buddy from Zac Brown Band, and Dan Huff in Nashville. And you know, you don't always agree, and you have to be open-minded, but we're that way anyway. I mean, we're an agreeable bunch when it comes to music. We're not, you know, we're really stubborn about most things, but when it comes to the music you're making, you got to be willing to take chances. If you're not, you'll just become stale, you know. But somebody said the other day, I was talking about if we would produce another record on ourselves, and somebody, I read it, I believe, it said, self-production is like self-dentistry. you got to be really careful.
Well, here, I'll give you a quote you can use. I liked what you said about, you know, trying not to go stale. Another, my take on that is the shark has to keep swimming or it dies, see?
Yeah, so exactly.
You can use that if you want. Have you ever worked with Rodney Mills? You familiar with him?
No. I know who he is, and he's a legend in this part of the country. But I've never met Rodney. I'm very familiar with his work, of course, at Studio One.
Well, I want you to reach out to Rodney, because he's there in Duluth, and primarily he does mastering these days. So certainly, yeah. If nothing else, you can work with him in that capacity. But he still does do some recording there, and got a cool, you know, it looks like a big sort of plantation-style house, but it is a modern build, and in the basement he's got his studio. And as you mentioned, he worked with everybody from Leonard Skinner to James Brown at different points in his in his career. And if for no other number one, he's fantastic at engineering and at mastering, but the other reason to go out there and to hang out with Rodney is just to listen to the stories.
I imagine
that's a lot of it. So the Blackberry Smoke, based in Atlanta, I know. But what's your story, Charlie? Where did you grow up, and when did you first learn to play guitar?
I grew up just north of Auburn, Alabama, which is about 80 or 85 miles south of Atlanta, southeast, I guess. And I started, my dad's a bluegrass guitar player, singer, still is, hobbyist. Mainly, but he is addicted to it just like all of us, you know. And so I can't remember there not being a guitar around. in my life. There was always, he was always playing and singing, and I would grab his guitars all the time, and he, I'm sure he got tired of that, of me grabbing his Martins, you know, and so he bought me a little cheap guitar when I was 6 years old, and he had already taught me the cowboy chords, pretty much, you know, and he taught me a few simple songs, and so I kind of lost interest for a little while after I got one of my own. It's like, oh, I've got it now. Okay, well, you know, and what does a six-year-old know? But then when I was about 11 years old, I really started getting interested in Aerosmith and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and the Rolling Stones. And I met this pothead buddy of mine. He was about 4 years older, and he gave me a guitar, and an electric guitar. And that was it. That was all she wrote.
What type of electric guitar?
It was a Height Deluxe, which was a copy of a Moserich,
Moserich model. That's very cool.
He painted it to look like Eddie Van Halen's guitar. It was all black and red and white striped. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever, because I had acquired the first couple of Van Halen records and was knocked out by that too, you know?
Yeah.
And then I saw some other, as I got a little older and I had friends coming around and they had, you know, Les Paul copies or Strat copies. And I was like, man, my guitar kind of sucks. It's kind of a dork guitar. And then I saw a picture of Johnny Ramone playing his Moserich. And I was like, wait a minute. No, it's not a dorky guitar. I got a punk rock guitar. But, you know.
You still have it.
I don't. It fell by the wayside somewhere. Sometime in life, but I'm sure it wouldn't be that interesting now.
Well, when did you realize that you wanted to play at least 250 shows a year?
I don't think I ever realized that I wanted to do that. We started touring in earnest, you know, in about 2002, I would say.
Yeah.
And the first time we rented a van, and we went on, the first tour that we went on, first run, was a month long with a band called Jackal from Atlanta.
Yeah.
And that was what lit the fire. I think it was exhausting, but we were a hard partying band back then, and we had a blast. And I think everybody was like, wow, okay, we can make enough money to do this to keep fuel in the tank and keep ourselves fed. Screw it. This is what we're going to do.
And where did you guys, you mentioned growing up in Auburn, Alabama, where did you meet the rest of the guys? Was that in Atlanta?
It was. I graduated high school in 92, and I moved directly to Atlanta. I had friends down around that area where I grew up that were musicians. And the idea then was, well, there's nowhere to play down in that area where we can play original music.
Right.
Everybody had to be in a cover band, which...
Right.
Myself and a few of my friends, you know, we were like, no, we want to write songs, and we want to be a band that actually goes and works and makes a record and not plays the VFW every weekend, you know? And so a handful of us kind of, you know, we took the plunge and moved to Atlanta, and I played in tons of bands from 93 to around 99 or so. And then that's when I finally, met the guys that now make up Blackberry Smoke, and everybody was in different bands, you know. But the type of music that we play and are interested in, the pool is kind of shallow. You know, there were not a lot of bands like what we wound up being.
Right.
So it was pretty much fate that we wound up together.
So you mentioned your father being really into bluegrass music. Have your parents been supportive of your pursuits?
Absolutely. Yeah. My dad, you know, he was into the bluegrass and the hillbilly music kind of thing. You know, he's not a rock and roll fan at all. Never really has been. But my mom, she, on the other hand, loved the Stones and the Beatles and Bob Dylan and the Beach Boys. And so I had those two completely different types of music, you know, coming from both directions. And I found a, some common ground, like in the song "Honky Tonk Women," the Stone song. It's a country song,
yeah,
you know, but
yeah,
with revved up guitars, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're very supportive. My dad has only seen us play once in all that we've been together 16 years, and he came to the Grand Ole Opry the first time that we guested on the Opry and played a couple songs, and he came. And he, you know, you got to understand, though, he's just not interested in coming to see a loud rock and roll show. It's just not his thing. So
right,
I forgive him.
But in that context,
that,
though, his boy was playing the Opry, so that must have been pretty great, right?
It was, and the way that the Opry is set up, I don't know, and we've been there a couple times, but it's a little odd for us, you know, because we're kind of a woolly rock and roll band. But there are bleacher type seats behind the band, and that's where a lot of special guests and people like that will sit. And so he sat behind us. He sat with my wife and my son, and I think I was more afraid of him being back there listening than I was the 4,000 people sitting in front of us. But he was excited. He got to meet little Jimmy Dickens and, I forget who else was there, but that was really big for him.
Yeah, very cool. Now, I've got a note here telling me that you're going to be part of an Outlaw Country cruise that sets sail late next February in Outlaw Country. That is a sister channel of ours here in the Underground Garage. They're over on Sirius XM 60. Have you ever played a cruise before?
Man, well, yes. This is actually the second annual Outlaw Country cruise with Steve Earle and the Mavericks and Lucinda Williams and tons of great artists that we'll be a part of coming up in February. But as far as cruises, we've done, I think this is going to be our 15th cruise, because starting back in 2005 maybe or 6, I forget, but we did 8 years of Lynyrd Skynyrd used to host a cruise, the Simple Man cruise, and we did all of those every year that they cruised. We did it, and then we did another cruise. It's called the Rock Boat with a band called Sister Hazel. We did 4 or 5 of those with them, 2 with Kid Rock, and 1 with Zach Brown. He hosted a cruise 1 year. So, and then we've done the Outlaw Country cruise last year. So I want to say, I don't know, I'll have to count on both hands and feet, but I want to say that it's 14 or 15. So yeah, well, we're pros at the cruise game.
I was just going to say, if you guys decide, you know, if for some reason you decide to take a hiatus at any point, you could just join the Merchant Marine, or,
you know what, I would have zero interest in. The cruises are great. I told my wife, I was like, if we weren't playing music on these cruises, you would never get me on another one. And that's not to say that they're not very enjoyable, because they are, but I put it this way. I talked to a guy that worked on the cruise ship, a guy from Australia, and we were having a drink years ago, and he started bawling and said, "I've been on this cruise ship for 8 months. I'm ready to go home."
Oh,
and,
man.
I was a shoulder for him to cry on there for about 10 minutes, and I hope that helped him.
Well, I hope he wasn't, like, press-ganged into that. That would have been terrible. But when you're on the boat, I mean, is it like you play a set at night, and the rest of the time you just hang out?
Well, there's music going on all day and all night. I mean, it's really, it's like a floating music festival. And that's, I don't want to deter anybody from going on a music cruise, because they're fantastic. And you never know what you're going to experience, because everybody's captive in there on the,
right.
Not literally, but you know, it's a captive audience. It's great. It's really great.
Well, the other tune I want us to take a listen to, give a spin to, is Working for a Working Man. Like Let It Burn, it's off the new album. And also, like Let It Burn, it draws attention to the sort of the average man squeeze. Have you been feeling that?
I think we all do. You know, if nothing else, that song might be the lament of the health insurance problem.
Yeah.
But no, it's just another, a working man's blues, really, you know, just a little louder and a little faster. But it's, you know, told from the perspective of somebody who is working as hard as they can and have for a long time, and it doesn't really feel like they've made any progress, really.
So the lyric in it is, "It ain't working for the working man," but the title of the song is "Working for a Working Man."
Double entendre.
Yeah. I say, are you a Woody Guthrie fan at all?
I am a Woody Guthrie fan, absolutely.
Well, then you're aware that his guitar killed fascists. At least he put it that did. On the back of the guitar. This machine kills fascists. Does your guitar kill
anything? I believe
anything?
That it did. No, notes. It kills notes.
Yeah. Hey, Charlie, thanks again for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you guys for having me.
All right. Well, we're going to take a listen now to Working for a Working Man. Here is Blackberry Smoke off Like an Arrow in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.